All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hello and welcome to a very, 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 I will say, special tribute edition of The Cinephiles. We lost, this is one of the greats. There's all sorts of people we've done tributes to, amazing actors, amazing directors, amazing writers and composers and all of those things. In the pantheon for me, John, and I should say I'm Steve Morris, a filmmaker, directing instructor in Los Angeles, California. In the pantheon of film actors,
yeah.
Gene Hackman is sitting there up on Mount Olympus. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah. By the way, it's John Rocha, writer, producer, and host. I would say, yes, I agree with you. And even more so over the last few days, brother, I've caught myself going into YouTube wormholes and watching like 10 to 15 minute compiled scenes of him from different movies. The MGM channel on YouTube, if you don't have that, highly recommend, or the Warner Archive channel. And they do a great job because they're all like 4K or HD. And you can really watch the greatness of Gene Hackman and his acting. And I watched about 10 minutes of the Little Bill stuff from Unforgiven. I watched some other stuff from other movies that were up there. And so I found myself going like, have I just always loved him and never really quantified it? You know, like you go, oh, Brando's my favorite, or De Niro or Pacino. I never really quantified how much I loved Hackman, but I feel such a connection to him as an actor. And I don't know if you feel that way too, but there's a blue-collar sensibility to his work that I think appeals to a lot of people who maybe grew up in those circumstances, in those situations, because he brings like an authentic realism to what he's doing. And when you watch him on interviews, there's no kind of arrogance there's a very strong point of view of what he believes, but there isn't that thing of trying to make it seem bigger than it actually is, you know? And he's almost British in that way for the ones who don't take acting too seriously.
It's so, you're right. It is really hard to quantify. Cause my brain was going, oh, well, it's because Gene Hackman does. No, that's not exactly it. Oh, it's because Gene Hackman is more. No, I mean, you're right. He is not acting part of his acting.
Yes.
It doesn't feel in a different, and it's like, you know, if we go that Brando is like the birth of naturalism,
right?
You know, like we go, you might say he's not acting, but that's not exactly how I feel about Brando.
Right. Well, Brando's performing.
He's performing.
Yes.
He's performing in a naturalistic way.
Yes.
Whereas there's this feeling of Gene Hackman sometimes that he just walked onto a set.
Yes.
And it's just being himself, even though the range of characters he's played is totally huge. He has a huge range. Yeah. But there's still that weird, completely authentic, natural quality to his performances that I adore, you know?
He has a self-composed energy. And I think that's very rare when you look at actors. It doesn't mean he didn't struggle with, you know, insecurities, imposter syndrome, things of that nature. I think all actors do that. But I think the fact that people voted him least likely to succeed at the Pasadena Playhouse is because he didn't do that thing that made you go, oh, you know, like Brando or Pacino or De Niro. His was more like realistic. In like you said, realism with what Brando, but no, actually realistic. It's almost reality show.
Yeah.
And I love the way you just said this. It's like he just walked onto the set and started delivering lines. And you're like, well, what? And that's the thing, that's the beauty about his work, is that you just kind of fall into, and you believe him. There, regardless of the movie, you believe Hackman's portrayal. Even in that terrible film with Dan Aykroyd, where they're cops together, he is so believable. I never saw Mooseport, but he is so believable even in the terrible movies.
So this is what we're going to be doing, I think, for quite a while, which is wrestling with the career of Gene Hackman. And the way we're going to start is we're re-releasing with fresh intros, of which this is one.
Yes.
Some of the films that we've done over the last 9 years with Gene Hackman. Mm. And today's is The French Connection. And this is going to be followed up by a re-release of The Birdcage. And I think we're going to get Mike Vogel to come on for a new intro because it is one of my favorite conversations.
Yes.
We're putting out Hoosiers again, Unforgiven, and Mississippi Burning. These are all incredible performances from Gene Hackman. And then as the culmination of this week of tribute to Gene Hackman, we're going to do another live show on Sunday on our YouTube channel. And there'll be details of that on social media of exactly when and the link and all of that stuff. But that's not all, because we feel that this is just an incredible actor who totally deserves an all new movie for us to do. And so we're trying to figure out, and maybe we'll get some help and suggestions from all of you, of which other Gene Hackman film we're going to dig deep into once we complete the season of the Coen brothers. So this, I mean, this has been, 2025 has been a busy year for the cinephiles, and it continues to be busy, but that is our plan at this moment.
Yeah. Can you tell we've been affected by the Gene Hackman death? I mean, I think people can tell that the fact that we're willing to do all of this stuff, especially coming out of a very, very busy February.
Yeah.
We're still willing to do this kind of stuff because we have such respect for him. And today's film is The French Connection. And this is the one that really fully announced him as an actor here, Steve. And this is a difficult film to watch. I mean, this I put this in the pile with The Searchers, in that you have a difficult protagonist, who at times is racist, at times is sexist, at times is brutal as a police officer, or as a detective rather. But to survive in that 70s New York, he is doing these things in order to capture what he sees as ultimately a truly villainous person who is affecting and destroying the world around him. And yet at the end, he doesn't get the job done. And it's so tragic. And I love this as a 70s film. Friedkin, great direction, the iconic car chase scene. But his performance as Popeye Doyle, as you said, it feels like you're watching someone just open the door for you and you walked out in New York Street and you're watching this guy doing the things that he's doing. It's so realistic.
I think your comparison of The Searchers is spot on, because in both senses, it's like, well, the Western is the classic tale of good guys in white hats go after bad guys in black hats. Yeah. And there is a lot of Westerns that follow that sort of binary approach. And then you get to The Searchers, where this brave, strong, talented, incredibly resourceful, disciplined human is going after what is a genuine crime of them kidnapping this girl, and they killed a bunch of people. And as we are with him, we are not comfortable.
Yeah.
It is not a comfy place to be, because the more you get to know John Wayne's character, the more you're like, this person is flawed and difficult and racist, and I don't know how I feel, and I don't know how I'm going to feel at the end. I think it's a very similar experience with Popeye Doyle, because the cops are the good guys, and these are drug dealers who are bad guys, and we have to go after them, and that's good. And the more you spend time with Popeye Doyle, who is a really good cop in all sorts of ways, the less comfortable you are with him. And I think, and this is the hallmark of 70s cinema, is giving you that experience.
I think that's one of the reasons I love Sicario so much, because it is a film, right, that like shows you, you know, the nice mamby-pamby way that we did. I don't know if anyone's even used that term before in life, but like the nice way we've done these things and how we approach the drug war. And here's the realist stuff. Here's the realistic way that it is. And I think Sicario portrayed that. And I think Friedkin portrays that here in The French Connection, and found a perfect actor to play this character of Popeye Doyle, because as you said, Steve, you know, the more time we spend with him, the less comfortable we feel, and it messes up even more, because he's right a lot of the time. And just like John Wayne, he's in The Searchers, he's right a lot of the time, and it frustrates you, because you want to believe in the black and white good versus evil. It's very clear-cut story, but the real truth is, when you're down on the ground, it's much more grayer. There are lines crossed all the time in an effort to stop what they see as the greater evil. So you make these sacrifices, or you cross these lines or blur these lines in order to do it. And his portrayal throughout the film is so essential to keep us just riveted on this pursuit of this villain.
I think these are the kinds of movies we really need today. And maybe some of that's happening. You know, there was a lot of independent films, obviously Anora, an independent film that won the Oscar that deals with sort of more gray and complicated human characters. Is that we've been living in a world which is very much about good guys and bad guys. Yeah. And this is pure evil. And we are the good people and must fight the pure evil. And I don't think that's the world.
Yeah.
And I think when our movies don't represent the world well, we get kind of sucked into this stuff. So I think having films that do have all these gray areas, like The French Connection, is what we need. Yeah. I think this is really important for our mental health to go, ah, things are not simple and black and white. Things are complicated and always fraught with gray areas.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, but you've got to have the right actor to pull that off, right? And Gene Hackman was the right actor because of his magnetic charm and his energy here, the way he uses the voice, the staccato at times back and forth that he has with the people that he is arresting or that he's shaking down to get information, along with, but companion that with his real genuine care for Roy Scheider and his affection for his partner. And so you get that mix throughout so that you kind of, just like a lot of us have in our lives, we have those friends or those family members who are like a little abrasive, a little quite not on the way we'd like them to be, but we can tell that there are people who really care about people and really care about the people that they love. And so all of that is there as you're watching this movie. And then as the tension builds and because it becomes more and more frustrated, you start to get really worried about how far he's going to go and where the limits are. Is because more and more people start to either question him or believe in him. So it really becomes this like figure that is slicing through both sides of the debate to walk his own path through the arguing factions to try to catch this guy. And it's a fascinating portrayal from top to bottom. And he makes that hat work like crazy.
So if you haven't spent very much time watching the work of Gene Hackman or his hat, or if you haven't spent that much time watching 70s cinema, or if you're not really familiar with the directing of William Friedkin, then we are very, very happy to take you back to the early days of the Cinephiles and the Academy Award-winning film, The French Connection.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. Again, this is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, host of numerous shows, including this one, and occasionally an actor. I had a film that just came out. Whenever this comes, it came out a few weeks ago, I guess, whenever we dropped this episode. And you can go see it if you want to see me do terrible acting. It's called You Can't Have It. Joanna Krupa, Armand Asante, Rob Gronkowski, and a number of people are in it. And you can
and directed and, by a buddy of yours,
directed
right?
by my friend Andre Gordon. Yeah, starring my friend Matt Polkamp, who's really great, and my friend Dade Elza, who's fantastic in the film. I am horrible, so you can go and see me do silent movie acting in a talking film. But you know, have fun.
I haven't seen it, but as always, I cannot imagine you being horrible.
It's true though.
Well, the movie we're talking about today is certainly not horrible.
No.
It is The French Connection, directed by William Friedkin, starring Gene Hackman, Roy Scheider. It's 1971, and this is a groundbreaking film.
Is this our first Friedkin?
This is our first Friedkin,
okay. So we haven't done Exorcist yet.
No.
Which we will have to do at some point. We've talked about that.
Yes, definitely.
But, okay, so yes. So
although Exorcist scares the crap out of me.
Me too.
Like that. So just briefly, just because you brought it up.
Yes.
It came out, I think I was like 5.
Oh, okay.
And I remember the commercials on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And the commercials were so scary that I left the room.
if the commercial came up. Wow. And I didn't see that movie until I was in my 20s.
Yeah, me too.
Because it was just, I was too terrified of it.
There are two films that were never allowed to be screened in my house growing up. Rosemary's Baby.
Yes,
and The Exorcist. To this day, I've still never seen Rosemary's Baby, but I've seen The Exorcist a few times. And it is a scary, including the extended edition, which is even scarier because it has that spider crawl down the stairs.
Rosemary's Baby is not as scary as The Exorcist, although it's deeply unsettling.
Okay.
And it's not surprising. I mean, you know, Catholic upbringing. And,
right.
I mean, it scared the crap out of a Jewish kid. It's really going to scare the crap out of a Catholic kid.
It's true.
But we are not talking about The Exorcist today. We are talking about The French Connection. John, how did you first come to this film?
I think I came to this probably on some Saturday afternoon, as I said before on this podcast numerous times. In Virginia / Washington, D.C., we had Metro Media 5 and WDCA Channel 20, and they would show old films in the afternoons, and that's when I became, like, and discovered my love of films, watching those things. And I think The French Connection was something I saw. I remember watching it some afternoon. I remember the ending really affecting me because there is no resolution.
Right.
And I remember...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, well, spoiler, right. If you haven't seen the movie, why are you listening? And if you go see this movie first.
Well, actually, that's something I want to bring up, because what we've heard from our Twitter followers is there are some people who go, they see that we're doing a podcast and they go out and buy the movie so they can watch it before hearing us.
Right.
And there's some people who said they really enjoyed listening to us first and then going to see the movie.
That's fantastic.
And I'm kind of curious if you want to let us know, which one are you? Like, what's your experience? And it helps us too in figuring out, well, how are we doing this for and who are we trying to talk to?
Right, right.
So anyway, so you went to see it.
Yeah, so, and I remember being very, and I became a massive Gene Hackman fan, you know, from that movie, I believe, and then seeing subsequently Poseidon Adventure and all these other films that he was in that I really enjoyed. And I will always champion Gene Hackman. I think he's one of my favorite actors, period. And this film, he's so, so dynamic. And he is 41 making this film. Still not a star. And 41 years old. Still not a star.
Well, he's about to be one.
Yeah, he's about to be one off this film. And so it's a fantastic film. I remember the grittiness of it. I remember, of course, the action sequence, the car chase, which is amazing. All of it was so just brutal and in your face. And there was no like moment of softness in the entire film. And it's powerful in that way.
For me, and this is going to surprise you.
Yeah.
This is not my movie. It hasn't been one. It's not one I've gone back to. I think I saw it the first time maybe in college.
Okay.
And then I saw it again maybe 20 years ago.
Wow, I've seen it many, many, many
and
times.
That's it.
Wow.
You know, and I've seen, of course, the chasing because it's in all sorts of retrospectives and
clips.
And, you know, I've seen that over and over again. I certainly know about the movie.
Right.
I appreciate why the movie's important. It was never one that drew me back. And I got to tell you, watching it this time, I once again appreciate so much about this film, but I don't go like, and I'm going to go watch it again.
Wow.
And I don't know. And this is something maybe came up, I think, with The Searchers. Mm-hmm. And I think The Searchers is more my film than this one is even.
Yeah.
And it's strange because I love the 70s. I love Gene Hackman.
Right.
I love so much of what the film is. And it's not, I don't know. But there's certainly a lot to talk about.
It's because you're a police chief, man.
What's that mean?
I'm the renegade cop. You're the police chief because you like things in a certain order. You like things to be done a certain way.
Yeah,
that's true. And that's just the way you are. So you probably felt more for the police chief trying to control Popeye Doyle than you do for Gene Hackman. And you might even feel more for Roy Scheider, who is still trying to control Gene Hackman.
I definitely feel for Roy Scheider.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Having been like a calm person trying to navigate stuff. Yeah,
I gravitate more towards characters like John Wayne in The Searchers, like Popeye Doyle in
it's a good point.
And it doesn't mean that you don't like antiheroes. You do like antiheroes,
I do.
In a certain way, in a certain construct.
Well, this is a chaotic and difficult movie.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. So let's get in a little bit of the background.
Sure.
So first of all, this is based on a true story.
Yes.
And in researching about this movie, I can't think of another movie where the real people who experience this are as involved as they are in this.
And acting in it.
Quite amazing. So there's Sonny Russo and Eddie Egan. Eddie Egan is Popeye Doyle.
Yes.
And his nickname was Popeye.
Yep.
And they did bust what was the largest heroin bust in history in the early 60s. And then there was this, and they were apparently the top narcotics cops. Mm-hmm. Like, they would bring in 1,000 criminals a year.
Wow.
I mean, it was like this huge number that was above and beyond anybody else.
Right.
And Eddie Egan was this larger-than-life, drunk, difficult, angry, obsessive character. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really was this kind of guy. And the book, The French Connection, had been written about them, and they really were involved in the whole writing of the book.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't write the book. And then... the rights were bought, and they were involved in the whole process of making the movie. I mean, they were there on the set every single day.
In fact, Eddie Egan is the one who plays the commissioner.
He's the Lieutenant Simpson or whatever his name is.
Who gets shot at the end, right? That's him, isn't that? Or is that the police chief? Is that the police chief?
So the FBI guy is the guy who gets shot at the end.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other guy who's
Lieutenant Simpson or
who's
whatever.
Who's constantly giving him shit.
Yeah.
In the back seat.
He's a great actor.
He's a great actor in this film.
And which is interesting because Sonny Russo, who's the other guy, who's the Roy Scheider character, who went on to be a TV producer, by the way, what he said is that it was all acting.
Yeah.
That it was the hard thing was figuring out who the real Eddie Egan is, because he's one of these guys who has this huge personality, and his personality as a cop, well, that was an act,
right,
to some degree. And what degree it is, we don't really get to know.
Right. As with the best ones, you don't really know.
So the rights are gotten by Phil Dantoni, who produced Bullet.
Oh, wow.
So he obviously had experience with car chases.
Right.
Like probably the best car chase before The French Connection
is in Bullet. Yeah.
And so that's one of the things he was drawn to. Hires William Friedkin. This is really his first real film. And he is a TV guy who really did documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
He did all these sort of aggressive, like, you know, Prisoner on Death Row and TV documentaries. He had a very kind of gonzo style in the 50s and the 60s. And them taking a gamble on him, really, a fairly low budget movie.
Yeah.
They went after a bunch of different actors before Gene Hackman, like Jackie Gleason.
Yes.
Can you imagine?
No, that's a whole other film. It's a whole other thing.
The first person they offered it to is Peter Boyle.
Yeah.
Which I can see. And Peter Boyle had just had a hit with another movie.
Yeah,
and
Joe.
With Joe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he went off and said, well, I want to do more romantic leads.
Peter Boyle. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Boyle. Look, who played Frankenstein in Young Frankenstein.
I love Peter Boyle.
Yeah, I love
him
to death.
He's a great actor, but I think he made a strange choice.
Yes.
And Gene Hackman, is a working actor for a long time.
Yeah.
He's a Midwestern guy. He grew up, one of his friends was Dick Van Dyke.
Yes.
Which is sort of interesting. And then his two best buddies are Dustin Hoffman and Robert Duvall.
Yep.
And they are working New York actors who are on television. And, Marion Doherty is the big casting director, really liked them and kept putting them in things.
Right.
And Gene Hackman is working and working and working and not a star.
Right. And by the way, casting by is a great documentary that you should watch about casting. And Marion Doherty is featured throughout that whole and talks about how she cast people like Hackman and Duvall and Pacino out of the 70s scene that was happening on stage at the time.
Because she was interested in these unusual, not leading man, different kind of intense people.
Right, and we should talk about this because the 70s, the cinema of the 70s was not about pretty people for the most part.
No.
It was about the grittier, because of the post-Vietnam stuff, it was all about discovering the gritty underbelly of these tent poles in our society, these, you know, police, military, government. It was exposing these kinds of things. And so you had to see the uglier side of all these parts of our society that we had always taken for granted as being utopian, protective of us, and, you know, couldn't possibly be corrupt. And Nixon and Watergate, Vietnam, all these things in the late 60s into the 70s conspired to create this taste in the American public to see these kinds of things portrayed in their films. And French Connection does that.
Well, absolutely. And there are all these things. Conspiring together is the right thing.
Yeah.
You also have things like the French New Wave and European cinema. And all of them are tackling issues and humanity in the way that we're not doing in the United States.
Right.
And our movies start to look kind of stale and old-fashioned and lifeless. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because one of the things I want to talk about is this movie, more than any that I can think of, seems to be the final death nail of the production code.
Oh.
Is that we talked about a little bit, we talked about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and that was one of the first movies that had swearing, and they released it outside of the code. And then you have things like Bonnie and Clyde, which is where Gene Hackman really, that's where he really kind of had a star turn, and people realized, oh, this is an interesting actor. And the violence and the sexuality of that kind of really pushed it out. And then this is what killed it. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up that I think is so interesting is when we think of the production code and the rating system, we think about basically three things, which is words, swear words, violence, and sex. Okay. And obviously those are things that we wanted to do more mature stories and be having people say fuck and shit and all those things. What's interesting to me is there are other elements of the code that we don't really talk about. And one of them is that authority figures were not supposed to do evil things.
Wow.
That was part of the code. So you can't have a policeman or a mayor or a president do things that are morally questionable unless the purpose of the film was for them to have a comeuppance. So unless at the end they were punished for their sins, is that another one is that people cannot use drugs or alcohol to become intoxicated. Right?
Okay.
Is that you could show someone drinking, but you couldn't show, and you couldn't show them enjoying being drunk. Is that people couldn't do things out of sexual desire. They could only do things out of romantic desire. And so all of these are all content things.
Right.
And kind of all of them get blown away in French Connection.
Yes.
Is that it's not just that they can swear and that there's violence or not that there's nudity in this film, but it's the whole nature of the kind of story you can tell is different.
Yeah.
When you get out of that code that went from the 30s through the late 60s.
Right.
That's fantastic. I think that's really important in this film.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it explains why something like Midnight Cowboy and Last Tango in Paris
were
outside of the code and considered X-rated films or non-rated films.
Right.
Right.
Because you just couldn't do those things.
Right. Exactly.
One of those movies I like, one of those movies I have no interest in at all.
I've never seen Last Tango in Paris.
That's the one I've seen it. And I'm like, I don't know
if I'll ever see that film.
Well,
maybe if we do it for the Cinephiles, I might see it, but I
have no interest in it.
Yeah.
And now that I found out certain stuff about it, that's really horrible. And it's like, no,
best not to do that.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. So let's move into the movie.
I love how we just did that. Grumble. Okay.
Here, John and Steve grumble on the Cinephiles.
It has been mandated.
One of the reasons that Phil DeTony, whatever his name is, one of the reasons that the producer picked Friedkin was because he liked the documentary aspect. Okay. And their choice in making the movie was to shoot it documentary style.
Yeah.
Like the way Friedkin set up this shoot.
Oh, yeah. By the way, real quick. Friedkin was convinced to do the film. He was dating Howard Hawks' daughter at the time.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yes. And he went to Howard Hawks and said, hey, they offered this film. Should I do this film? What do you think of my films? And Howard Hawks says, your films suck. Like he said, your films suck. He did this in an interview. I think it's on one of the DVDs. And he said, but what you can do is direct the best action sequence that's ever been directed, and then you'll make a name for yourself.
Huh.
And so he took on this mantle, because you're right. It was a low-budget film. They couldn't afford everybody. Like, they wanted Steve McQueen, couldn't afford him.
Right.
Lee Marvin didn't want to do it.
Because
he hates cops. Like, Lee Marvin was well-known for hating the military and hating cops, which is why when he played these characters, he always played it so that they would expose the underbelly of the organizations they were a part of, and he didn't see that with Popeye Doyle.
All right, so we started Marseille, and one of the interesting things you find out right away, this movie's not going to spoon feed you anything.
Nope.
Yeah, you're just in here. You don't know what's going on.
Better pay attention
to these people. You got to pay attention to what's happening.
Don't be playing on Twitter or on your Instagram or when you're watching this movie. Like, you got to watch this movie. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to pay a lot of attention. We see there's an assassination.
Yes.
We don't particularly know why,
mm-hmm.
and then we go to Brooklyn. And we see this guy in a Santa Claus suit. And again, we don't get to know what's going on.
Yeah.
We see Roy Scheider go into this bar and aggressively in this really, like the scariness kind of the situation they're in is fairly intense.
Mm-hmm.
Chase this guy out. He gets cut with a knife. We chase him down through, and we got to say, New York in the late 60s, early 70s. That's a scary place.
Well, listen, I think New York is still a scary place.
Nothing like it was then.
But the freedom with which what they could do with suspects, with people they caught.
Well, and it's scary in both ways because and we've seen crime statistics lately that have been misquoted, but there was a huge crime wave in the late 60s and early 70s.
Right.
And the murder rates were really, really insane. And when they have that shot down the alley and there's just something on fire and it's garbage everywhere, and that's what was going on then.
Yeah, yeah.
That world isn't this way now.
Right.
And as you say, the police brutality is really, really scary.
Unsettling. I mean, the way they beat the guy up once they catch him, like it's almost a beating like you would see a Rodney King type beating. They just keep punching and kicking him and whatever, and then eventually throw him up against the wall and start asking him questions, playing an extreme version of the good cop, bad cop.
I want to bust you.
Let me talk to you.
You got a friend here, buddy. You got a friend.
You gonna tell us who your man is?
When's the last time you picked your feet, Willie?
Who's your connection, Willie? What's his name?
What?
Answer him.
So when they're interrogating this guy, Popeye Doyle keeps asking, "Have you ever picked your toes in Poughkeepsie?"
Yes.
Hey, shithead. When's the last time you picked your feet?
Huh? What's he talking about?
I've got a man in Poughkeepsie who wants to talk to you. You ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Hey, Aaron, what you talking about?
Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you?
I want to hear it! Come on!
Yes, I've... You've been there, right?
Yeah.
You sat on the edge of the bed, didn't you? You took off your shoes, put your finger between your toes and picked your feet, didn't you?
So I found out what that is, which is apparently this is really something that Eddie Egan would ask.
Oh.
That was a regular thing that he would ask. And what it was there had been a famous rape in Poughkeepsie. And in the rape, the rapist had picked his toes, sat on the edge of the bed and picked his toes while the victim was still lying on a bed.
Oh.
And horrible, horrible story.
Right.
And so what he was doing was he was scaring the person he's interrogating by asking them about this much worse crime.
Yeah.
So that they were so frightened that they would get caught as this rapist, which they weren't,
right,
that they would admit what they had done to Sonny, to the right partner. So it's this strange version of good cop, bad cop, and also this just sort of surreal distraction under stress that he would do to the person he's interrogating to get them to admit what they had done.
Psychological, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just so weird. It's just such a weird, weird thing to bring up.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, that first scene where Gene Hackman wants to hit him and there's like this interrogation, they tried shooting that right at the beginning of the shoot and Gene Hackman really couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And he had real trouble with it. And he kind of was like, I think they're going to fire me and maybe I shouldn't do this role. Mm-hmm. And the real Popeye Doyle's on set and just goes, who is this guy? Like, he's not me. Let me play the part.
Yeah.
You know, I'll do it.
Which is valid.
And by the time they come around, they do shoot that scene again near the end of the movie. Hackman was there.
Right.
He got there. It took a little while.
Well, I would imagine so. And he said that he was really uncomfortable saying some of the dialogue that he has to say. Yeah. Like some of the dirty dialogue, some of the
racist
stuff. Yeah. I mean, it was really hard for him, you know. So that speaks to the who he is as a character. But also, like, creating that character. What it took out of him to create that character.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a rough guy to be in,
yes.
Popeye Doyle.
Yes. Not a redeeming characteristic within that guy other than
he's
a good cop. But he is like, he seduces women. He's derogatory about how he speaks with them, you know, speaks about them. He uses the N-word. He's like aggressively pursuing this situation to the expense of other people. It's alluded to later on in the film when he gets with that Eddie Egan's character that something had happened in an investigation
that cost
the life of a cop that this guy won't let him go about. You know, so
and he doesn't seem to show a lot of regret.
Not at all.
You know?
Not at all.
And it's interesting. So Roy Scheider asks Sonny Russo, the real partner, like, how did you, because they were partners for 15 years.
Wow.
And no one had ever been Eddie Egan's partner that long.
Right.
He ran through partners like crazy. No one could stand
him. I'm sure.
And he said, how did you stay partners with this guy so long? And Sonny Russo's answer was, he was my partner. If I didn't love him, who would?
Right.
You know?
That's
and
fair.
And Roy went, I got it. And there's this moment, like, after they bring this guy in, that Roy's like, okay, and he's been wounded, and he's like, okay, I'm going to go home and go to bed. And Popeye Doyle goes, come on out. Let's go to a club. Let's go do this thing. And they're at a club, and there they see this guy who seems to be getting a lot of money. And you see that moment of instinct with Popeye Doyle, and he goes, okay, let's go follow him. And it's like, I haven't been to bed. Like that. And they end up going all night. And apparently, this is what they did over and over again.
Again.
Popeye Doyle was never, Eddie Egan, the real guy, was never not on the job.
Wow.
He was drunk and would be up all night drinking, and then he's on the job, and then he's up all night doing the job, and up all day doing the job,
good
and drinking,
God.
And just never stopped.
No wonder he was difficult to work with.
Really difficult.
Constantly moody.
So then, as you say, we go back to Marseille, we meet his...
Well, we're introduced first to Fernando Rey, who will be our villain.
Oh, you're right.
Right, in Marseille. Like he's got this young wife.
Girlfriend?
It looks like his wife.
Wife?
Probably girlfriend, wife, something that is, because he mentions his daughter, and... Yeah. You know, she mentions like she wants to know if we're still happy, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a very sweet moment between them. But then again, you realize this guy is the main villain. This guy's going to be your main villain to a degree because the way they're portraying. And she brings out the jacket that is going to be
elegant.
Yeah. And it characterizes the character. Like it characterizes him throughout the first, throughout this movie and the sequel as well.
That and the cane and the facial hair.
I've never
seen the sequel.
You've never seen the sequel?
Yeah.
Oh, it's an interesting sequel. It's obviously it's not as good as the first one. But it's a total fabrication from beginning to end. But an interesting film.
Because the real guy, the real French guy, he was a buddy, grew up with Charles de Gaulle.
Yes.
And was an actual resistance fighter against the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And like a fairly big hero that became this really big drug dealer.
Yes.
Which none of that's in the movie, right. But it's sort of interesting about the real guy.
Yeah.
So we go off on this big stakeout,
yes.
Following this guy around. And again, the movie is not spoon feeding you anything. Nope. And what I was thinking watching it this time was I went, this is almost like the first procedural.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Good point.
Like where it's really interested in how do the cops do what they do?
Yeah.
And what is the process?
Right.
And they make it very real. There's nothing romantic about this stakeout. It's,
yeah.
It's boring and it's cold and it takes a long time and you don't know what you're
going
to get.
But once again, the derogatory comments, all that stuff going in, you know, they're commenting about the people they're watching, you know, and they're looking at these kinds of things. And we get introduced to Tony LoBianco playing that character.
Right.
Really great actor, Tony LoBianco. Really great character actor showing up in multiple movies and TV shows. And so I love that we have these characters and they pick the right actors, you know, to put these situations into motion so that we can follow them through this process.
What's interesting, so Friedkin doesn't storyboard. That's not his style.
Okay.
What he likes to do is, which I actually would really recommend for filmmakers, is that what he does is he goes to location with his DP on it to scout it out.
Yeah.
And then walks through the shots with the DP and figures it out on the set.
Okay.
But then the other interesting thing that he does
is
that, which I've never heard of anyone ever doing, is he does a rehearsal with the actors.
Yeah.
And he has the gaffer, who's the guy in charge of lighting, light the set.
Okay.
But he doesn't let the camera operator in the room.
Wow.
And so what he did, and the camera operator he's using is a guy who had done all sorts of documentaries, did documentaries in Cuba during the revolution, and it's a real documentary guy. And so what he did was they rehearsed the scene is everything's lit, invite the camera operator in and have him just shoot without knowing what's going to happen.
Right.
And so he's following it like a documentary. So he's trying to figure out what to shoot and what to shoot. And that's part of what gives it that documentary feel.
Right.
That seems really hard to do. But it does. This movie doesn't look like anything else.
No. And you know what's interesting? Throughout the whole film, he doesn't always have the permits for the stuff that he's shooting. He doesn't always have permission to do the stuff that he's doing. And especially when we get to the car chase scene, there are certain moments that are really happening as opposed to mapped out. And so this is, and also this is a kind of the Wild West kind of filmmaking too from the 70s as well. This idea of realism, this gritty realism, trying to achieve that any way possible. And they certainly do that in this film on numerous occasions.
And sometimes risking a lot of people's lives to do it, which we're going to get into when we get to that chase.
Yeah.
So we're staking out this candy store restaurant and trying to figure out, are they dealing drugs? Are they not? How is this working? And again, it's not spoon feeding you anything. Nope. You're just observing. I love the scene, by the way, where Roy Scheider's goes in and is actually talking to the girl and trying to kind of make a date with her.
Have her wear the dress or whatever, model the dress or whatever.
It's a great, great little scene. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. So now we're going to go and roust out this bar.
Yeah.
All right, Popeye's here. Get your hands on your heads. Get off the bar and get on the wall. Come on, move. Move.
Hey, you dropped that. Pick it up.
Hold those hands up.
Pick it up. Come on, move.
What are you looking at?
All right, bring it here. Get your hands out of your pockets. What's my name?
Doyle.
What?
Mr. Doyle.
Come here. You pick your feet.
This seems crazy to me.
Why?
Well, the arrogance of the guy walking into this bar with all of these criminals, because they sure seem like they're all criminals.
Yeah.
He doesn't pull a gun out or anything.
No. Nope.
Just says, Popeye's here.
Yeah.
And just all of the drugs and all the stuff that pops out of people's pockets.
Right.
Yeah.
That they drop as they're walking to be put against the wall.
Yeah.
They drop on purpose, so there's not all found on their persons.
Yeah. And you know, there's a racial element in this scene that I don't quite know how to feel about.
Yeah, but it's the 70s and it was that time and he's that kind of thing. But like they were trying to get to the black undercover cop. That's what they were trying to do. So they rousted everybody.
Is he an undercover cop? I thought he was just an informant.
No, I thought he was an undercover cop. Mm. It seemed like he was an undercover cop because of the way they communicate with each other.
Right.
He doesn't treat him like an informant, like, you know, like submissive to dominant. It's more colleague-like in their conversation.
Yeah.
So in my mind, it seemed like he was an undercover cop there. And he's like, how you doing, man? How's it going? Blah, blah, blah. Hey, get this number. Where do you want the punch? Like, you know what I'm saying? And so it felt to me like he was undercover.
Which, by the way, that where do you want it? That's a thing that's kind of become a cliche, I think.
Yeah.
That you've seen a lot of other, and this is, you know, this is where this comes from.
Right, right.
By the way, one other thing, all those guys in that scene, those are all cops. They're all real New York cops that Eddie and Sonny brought in
to
play out that scene.
That's perfect. Yeah. But we're slowly piecing together this mystery of this heroin situation, what Tony LoBianco's character has to do with this, while we're slowly piecing together on the other side the French stuff that's happening, because you have him like trying to recruit this TV personality to be part of this. He's talking to his number one henchman, and he's recruiting this TV personality. He's going to use this TV personality because apparently this TV personality needs money.
Right.
And so he's using him to transport the heroin into the States in his car that he is bringing over on a ship. You know, so we're discovering all this stuff. So the pieces together are happening on one side of the world, and the other pieces are coming together on the other side of the world. And Popeye Dole is like, he thinks he's going to have, it's a small bust, and it's the bust is becoming bigger and bigger.
Yeah. You know, it just occurred to me as you were saying that.
Yeah.
Is that we talked about how this film isn't spoon feeding you any information.
Right.
Is that what occurred to me is that as you're trying to figure things out, that's what Eddie Egan is doing.
Yes.
That's what Popeye Doyle is doing. Yeah. Is that we have a hunch.
Mm-hmm.
We know something is happening.
Right.
We don't know what that thing. We don't know what that car is.
Right.
We don't know what this TV guy is trying to do.
Yeah.
We don't know the connection between the French guys and the guys that we're following. Mm-hmm. But we know that there is a
French connection. Boom, nailed it.
but we don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where Popeye Doyle is.
Yeah.
Is sort of just figuring. There's something happening. I don't know what it is.
And the great films that have these kinds of mysteries make you feel that way. Make you feel that you're discovering it along with the character. And it's awesome because you feel like you're just as intelligent as the character. Because if the character can't figure it out, I can't figure it out, then we're going to figure it out together.
Right.
You know, it feels like you're becoming part of the protagonist's story.
As opposed to, and here are all the clues.
Right.
And Sherlock Holmes is going to, a Sherlock Holmes story, he knows everything and
yes.
you know nothing. And
right.
then he figures it out and then he'll explain to you how
exactly.
he figured it out.
Exactly.
This is not that. This is you're in there with them yep. trying to figure it out.
Right.
We do meet the real Eddie Egan for the first time.
Yes.
He's the lieutenant, kind of comes down on, it's obvious that Popeye Doyle is not the most popular guy.
Right.
And then there's this shot. And I think this shot is so important to the movie, which is that it's morning and Popeye Doyle is sort of waking up in a bar.
Yes.
From being drunk.
Yeah.
And that is a weird moment in a movie.
Yeah.
Because what is that saying to you?
He's been there all night.
Yeah.
This is his life.
Yeah.
Like the guy has no real life. Even when he has that seduction of the girl riding the bike, which is really creepy and weird because she's a young girl. And the cuffs and all that. These are just interludes, but his real life is falling asleep at a bar every night, you know, waking up, going right to the job, doing the job, falling asleep at a bar, doing the job. Some men really are built this way. And I've come across a few of them in the military. This is their lives, man. Drinking, doing the job, drinking, doing the job, drinking. I'm not one of those guys, but I've experienced that on numerous occasions with certain people.
I certainly like a drink.
Sure.
I enjoy it. Well, some people don't.
Okay. All right, fine. Their loss. But yes, go ahead.
I certainly enjoy that. But the idea of drinking alone all night
mm-hmm.
in a bar
mm-hmm.
and even just what's the bartender doing when you're kind of out at the bar?
Well, what can you do? He's a cop. You can't do anything.
I guess that's a good point.
Right. You can't do anything.
And then just getting up and going to work and then doing it again. And
right.
then, as you say, we get this very strange pickup with the girl with
yeah.
the boots on the bicycle.
Yeah.
And so here's the thing to make it even more disturbing. So apparently Eddie Egan really did this.
Oh.
And he did like women with boots. That was a thing that he liked. And that he would arrest them. And
there you go.
And it was, and what Sonny Russo describes it is as it was sort of a playful arrest.
Sure.
And that would lead to sex.
Okay.
But man, that's some weird.
That's a line you're walking, right?
I don't understand.
Right.
We don't know what that
no,
is.
No, and our society in 2017 would look at that and be like, no, that's incorrect. What you're
yeah.
doing is wrong. Abuse of power, blah, blah, blah. But back then, men of that time, men of that ilk, used those situations, thinking they were seducing women and whatever, and they enjoyed the joy. They enjoyed the aspect of that.
Yeah, it's still
like excusing it.
It still might have very well have been abuse of power, and
right.
probably
yeah,
was
absolutely.
But it wasn't maybe perceived that way,
right?
As we with our more modern eyes would look at it. But
right.
it's pretty weird. And then we have the next scene where here comes Cloudy,
yeah.
Roy Scheider to his door, knock knock knock,
yeah,
and. I love the fact that he says, let yourself in, and he pulls out his little lock pick.
Yeah.
And he picks the lock, and there's Popeye Doyle
yeah.
on the bed.
Handcuffed.
By his ankle.
Yes.
Naked, we assume.
Right.
Girl's still in the other room.
Yeah.
It is some weird stuff.
Yeah. Well, this gives you another element to this kind of guy this kind of the kind of person he is, right? Is this this kind of situation he gets into and sleeping in the bar, meeting these women, having these one night stands? Like, this is just his life, man. It's all about the job. Nothing else matters but the job.
Well, and this is why I brought up the thing before about the code, the production code. None of this can happen.
Yeah, good point.
You know what I mean? Like, he's a guy who abuses his power. Yep. He's a guy who is an alcoholic. He's a guy who's sleeping with women in these very non-loving ways.
Right.
And, like, all of the stuff that makes up the character of Popeye Doyle, which is one of the great characters, can't exist 5 years earlier in the film world.
Right.
Can't exist. Just won't happen.
Yeah.
And now we're back on the job.
Yep.
So we see another little piece of what the plot is, which is that we're going to the scrapyard to pick up a car.
Yes.
That got me a little confused. I think what it is that's how they're going to ship the money back to France? Yes. Is that what's going on?
Yes, yes. Okay. They're picking the car. Because he switches cars later on in the film when they bring, after they, you know, discover the heroin in the car, they put it back in and they let him drive the car. Alain Chiron is the name of the guy. They let him drive the car to the body shop that's out in the middle of the woods, and then they switch cars. And the switched cars are the cars that they're using to bring back the money to France. And that's what they arrest him in, or try to arrest him in, when he's pulling away with Tony LoBianco in the passenger seat.
I gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Because again, it's not spoon feeding so we know there's something going on.
Yep.
So the first thing they get the rights to have a wire.
Yes.
And we're listening in, and there's a great scene where they're like playing cards.
Yeah.
And they finally get the French guy calling in, and the silliness and the giggliness is really fun to watch.
The joy of it all.
The joy
of,
like, we've got them.
Yeah.
And that's what allows them to bring the feds in.
Right.
And then there's definitely some tension between Popeye and Cloudy and the feds.
Right. Because they petition for this money, they petition for the help, they petition to focus on each other, there's wiretaps, whatever they're trying to do. All of this manpower to try to catch this guy, because Popeye is starting to understand the size of the bust that we're talking about. Yeah,
and they definitely need some help, and I guess New York PD doesn't have the resources.
Right,
and so we go off and we have this following them, which I really love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they called it is it's a triangular follow or something like that.
Yeah,
which is one person falls for a little while and then they move on and someone else picks it up. And again, it's this procedural thing. It's really fun to watch how they do this.
Yeah. And how they get caught out doing it, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a great scene on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah.
And you know how they did that?
No.
So Eddie Egan and Sonny Russo are on the film.
Right.
And Eddie Egan and Sonny Russo, they know all the cops in New York. And so they just say, hey, we need to block off the Brooklyn Bridge. So with no permission, no permit, no anything, they just have some cops block off the Brooklyn Bridge for 20 minutes. And you just imagine... This is the Brooklyn Bridge, this is New York. Like, the amount of traffic they caused with no permission or permits, and they're just walking around and shooting it, and that's kind of how this movie went.
Yeah. Too bad they didn't have Chris Christie back then. He could have could have done it officially.
Yeah. Well, maybe they worked on his campaign. Who knows? And as we're doing this tale, this triangular tale, the people, they're just real New York people.
Yes.
We're not setting up lights. We're just shooting it documentary style in the world. Those cars that are going by are real cars. They're not controlling the street. There's, you know, no safety precautions. It is a run and gun kind of filmmaking.
Yeah. And you can sense that as you're watching it, like these real life extras, because they're like really walking through scenes and doing whatever. And you get that sense of New York. You get the realism of New York. And because that's what New York is known for. They're not known for making a big deal about anything. They just go on with their lives, whatever, you know?
And it feels different.
Yes.
It feels real.
It feels documentary style almost. Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. And it's funny. I think there's definitely something lost when you have to cordon off a whole area, populate it with extras, costume them appropriately, and organize exactly where they're going to walk, when they're going to walk.
Yeah.
You cannot create this.
No.
You could create a beautiful scene, but it won't be this.
Yeah.
This ends with, this sort of chase ends with our French guy, what's his name again?
Alain Chiron. Yeah.
Goes into this restaurant.
Yes.
Eats a very French meal.
He does.
It is like escargot and French onion soup and beef bourguignon and red, you know, it's like, it's really as Frenchy as you can get.
As French as you can get.
Which to me is like, if I go from the U.S. to go to France, I don't eat American food. I would want to eat French food.
Yes, of course.
But this guy, he's going to French it up.
Yeah.
And standing outside on what was both in the film and apparently in real life, the coldest day of the year is Popeye Doyle.
Yes.
And he looks cold.
Yeah.
And apparently it is really cold.
Not a surprise, man.
And again, it goes to this procedural aspect. This is what the life of this cop is.
Yeah.
And there's no quit in Popeye Doyle.
Nope.
There, it never occurs to him like, can someone else do this? Can I go home? He's like, I'm going to stay here and watch this guy.
Right.
So we start to see a little bit more of the plot, which is we see some lab experiment where we test out the drugs.
Yes.
Apparently they get very good heroin in France.
Apparently.
But don't know where. Maybe it's coming. Oh, I wonder. Maybe it's coming from Vietnam.
Yeah, probably.
You know, because that's French Indochina in the early 60s, which is when this really took place.
Right, poppies and all that.
Because I don't think they grow poppies in the south of France.
I don't think so either.
I don't know.
I'm not a drug dealer, so I wouldn't
know. Those of you out here who are heroin addicts.
or drug dealers.
If you want to tweet us.
Yes.
With the information on where, in fact, you do get the good heroin in France, we'd be happy to.
Yes.
Know.
And please tag your local police department.
Yes, exactly. I think it's a really good idea. See, we do a good thing for the community.
Yes, absolutely. A service we provide.
By the way,
yeah,
that's real heroin in that shot.
What?
Apparently.
Wow.
This is what Friedkin says.
Right.
By the way, so I've heard him talk a fair amount. I don't know that I believe him all the time.
Well, of course not. Just like Orson Welles, you don't believe him half the time.
I mean, I expect everybody exaggerates whenever they tell their story. They always make it a little. But Friedkin says some stuff that I kind of go, really?
Yeah.
And so, but he says that's real heroin.
Okay.
I don't understand the point of getting real heroin.
Well, that's the 70s, man. Everybody wanted to be so real, wanted to dial into that realism. And
I guess you're right. I'm the police chief. It's why would you do that? Just get some white powder. It doesn't matter. Like, what does it matter?
Yeah, right.
But no, that's real heroin. And what he says is that the test they're doing is the real test.
Oh, wow.
And so turning that color, that is actually with mercury and how he said they do it.
Yeah. And he's doing the value of the heroin. You know, that's a great little sequence when it's going all the way up. You know, it's so great to hear his comments as he goes over there. It's almost like he wants to say disco at the end.
So the next so the next thing that happens is that all the other cops except Popeye Doyle fuck up.
Yep.
And our frog number one, which is what they call him. Yep. Please excuse me for using that term to all the French people listening.
That's a good point. That is a derogatory
term.
That
is a derogatory term.
For the French, yes.
Our French gentleman gets out of the hotel. Nobody sees.
Right.
And now before we had this triangular tail, now it's just Popeye Doyle on foot. I love this sequence.
Right.
It's so well done. And for a while, you're kind of going, does he know he's being tailed? And then it's like, oh, yes.
Yes.
He knows he's being tailed.
He's caught him twice. Because remember, he caught him the night when he tailed him as well. So he catches him twice. It's so great. And Fernando Rey is so fantastic in this part as Alain Chanier. He's just so great with just the subtlety of everything he's doing. Because I think Fernando, isn't he the guy who plays the Turkish guy in Lawrence of Arabia, who does the assault or the rape of Lawrence of Arabia?
That's Jose Ferrer.
I'm sorry. Yeah. So Fernando Rey was Cyrano de Bergerac. He won.
No, that's Jose Ferrer.
That's Jose Ferrer?
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Those guys look so familiar to me.
They do. They look really similar.
Okay.
He was in Buñuel films or something.
Oh, that's right. Because that's how he got cast. It was by mistake.
Mistake.
Yeah. They wanted the other guy that was in the film Belle du Jour.
But the guy didn't speak English.
Well, they actually,
he said to this casting director, get the guy in Belle du Jour. Yeah. And they fly him out this guy. And he goes, that's the wrong guy.
Yeah, but.
And then they find the other guy and then they find out, he doesn't speak English.
So it works out.
Works out great.
Yeah, it works out for Fernando Rey. He does two of these films. So.
And him going in and out of the subway.
Yeah.
And I love that they're both acting like they don't know that they're, you know, what's happening.
Yes.
They're both. I mean, it's so obvious that they know that you are chasing me and I am chasing you, but they're pretending they're not. And the final moment of the wave.
Oh, that was brilliant.
It's beautiful.
And it's so well acted. Like, oh, sorry, guy.
Yeah.
It's so well. And it gets called back later on in the film when they catch him, too, which is perfect as well.
Yeah. We go off to Washington.
Yes.
And that's the real Sonny Russo, who's the guy on the binoculars in Washington. That's him.
The reason they were in Washington was because the tails were happened. They were being tailed all over the place in New York, right?
And
they thought they go to Washington, they have this conversation, and we find out in that conversation between Alain and the Tony LoBianco character that Tony wants to take some time, like to let the heat die down a little bit. But Alain is driven.
No, we got
to
get this deal done
because we got to get back to France. He wants to get back to his wife. Wants to get back to his life back there. He doesn't feel safe in New York. It's not as smooth as he was hoping.
And then we get back on the plane, and I love, by the way, some of the period things of, you don't see a plane with seats like that
where
they're facing each other. Oh, one other period thing I was thinking about watching then is hats.
Yes.
Because I was thinking about it's like from the beginning of the 20th century until this moment,
yeah,
men wore hats.
Yes.
And from this moment forward, the early 70s, that's the end.
Yeah.
No young people wore hats. And all the time that we were going, you know, I don't know if your dad wore a hat. My dad didn't wear a hat.
My dad almost never wore a hat.
Yeah. But my grandfather, they wore hats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was only old guys that wore hats until the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And now hats are back.
Yeah, hats are back.
But there was this 30-year period where, like, hats was just like an old-fashioned thing.
Right, right. And his hair was growing out.
I get. Oh, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Because yeah. The hippie generation.
And all that kind of stuff. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. It's just interesting to see. And it's on this plane where we make the decision of we're going to kill Popeye Doyle.
Right. With his number one henchman who had killed the guy at the beginning of the movie.
Who's a good, scary assassin type guy.
Absolutely. And Elaine, to his credit, Elaine does not want to kill Popeye Doyle. Doesn't think it's a good idea. But this guy says, I can do it. I can snipe him. No problem. We'll get it done.
Yeah. And so from what I've read, much of this movie is very accurate in terms of how it did. The two big things that aren't is the time. This sting took over 2 years of work. And in the movie, it's much more compressed, which is not surprising.
Right.
And there is no assassination attempt on Eddie Egan. Well, and no giant chase thing. They did chase each other a little bit, but nothing
like
this.
No surprise.
And this, and you know, Popeye Doyle's at a pretty low place at this moment.
Yeah.
He just lost the guy. The case has sort of fallen apart. Mm-hmm. And then that sniper bullet kills a woman right in front of him. It's really scary.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
And he chases him on foot up through the stairway, finds the rifle, sees him down on the ground. And now we get the just tenaciousness of Popeye Doyle.
Right.
This guy is not going to quit.
Nope.
He is just going to keep. And one thing that occurred to me watching it this time, by the way, boy, people in movies sure can't sprint a long time.
Well, the fact that he could run all the way up to the top of the building and then all the way back down and he's still only maybe half a mile behind the guy is amazing to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
see it with Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is an expert runner in films.
Sure.
Maybe not Gene Hackman.
Sure, but even an Olympic runner, if you sprint a 440, that's as far as anybody sprints.
Yeah, you're going to get
tired. And I was watching, Popeye Doyle does not take good care of himself.
He does not. So I just there's a lot of liquor in there. Right?
Yeah, and a lot of sleepless nights and strength. Yeah, I mean, smokes and this is.
Right.
But he sprints after this guy. We end up at the elevated train.
Yeah.
Gets on the wrong track. The guy gets on the train. And now we are going to commandeer a car and chase a train.
Yeah.
And this is arguably one of the greatest car chases of all time.
Absolutely. It's still one people cite even to this day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is so good and so emotionally full and so scary and feels so real. And part of that is because a lot of it is real.
Yeah. Yeah, they'd only cordoned off like 4 blocks for it. And then they kept going past those 4 blocks and actually darting around real cars, real people who are there, all of the, except for the baby with the mom, all that, most of it was not staged or coordinated, and it was done, and Friedkin was in the back seat shooting this.
He's in the back seat shooting.
Right, because all the other cameramen had wife and kids, and he did not.
And so this is where I don't entirely trust Friedkin.
Okay.
What he says is they were going 90 miles an hour.
What?
I don't really believe they were going 90 miles an hour. And he said none of it was controlled. And Hackman says they were going 70, maybe up to 70 miles an hour.
Right.
And he said that Egan and Russo did have cops and they had a lot more of a control.
Right.
What Hackman says, one of the things they didn't control was they're keeping new cars off the road.
Right.
But people who are in the houses, they don't know what's going on.
Right.
And so what happened was guy comes out, gets in his car, it's in the morning, pulls out. Hackman is driving the car and slams into him. And sounds like a pretty good accident.
Yeah, it does.
Pretty good accident. And I'm not sure if that one's on film. And some of the other accidents are real things that happen.
Yeah.
And what Friedkin says, whether it's as crazy as how he describes it, that he would never do it today and that it's totally irresponsible. And I really agree.
Yes, I agree.
There's a quote that I love from Bob Dylan that I think about often, which is, it's actually, I first read it in Watchmen in the comic book, but the quote is, in order to live outside the law, you must be honest.
Oh.
And I think about this all the time, and there's a lot of ways to interpret it, because that's what a good quote is. It's one that you go, what does he mean? But the way I interpret
like
it is that once you decide to not obey the rules of society, then you are taking on the mantle of morality and care for other humans on yourself.
Yes.
Is that so? If you go, okay, I'm not going to permit this. Well, then you've said you're no longer let the rules of society protect your crew or the other people in the world. You are saying, I'm going to protect them because I have taken on this responsibility.
Yeah.
And frequently what happens is people just go, I'm going to do this because I want to do it.
Right.
And they don't think, and as you know, Friedkin's a young guy. And when you're a young person, you just don't think that stuff's going to happen.
Yeah.
But Hackman could have been killed.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and the guy, some guy who just got in his car in the morning, he could have been killed.
Right.
And they came pretty damn close to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing you learn, I think, as you live longer and as a filmmaker, is that shit's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that you need to prepare for that. And the longer you do it, the more likely that shit's going to happen.
Right.
And that those are important responsibilities.
Absolutely.
The chase scene is great.
Yep.
Super tense.
Not a lick of no song.
Nope.
No theme song, nothing plays. It's all just the sounds of the chase and the sounds of the subway and the sound, you know, the guy kills the cop
the
cop and then shoots at the MTA worker and then the person driving the train is actually
a train driver.
Yeah, because the guy that they had hired didn't show up on set that day.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they had to shoot it and that guy just volunteered to do it. So there he is acting out, having essentially a heart attack or passing out on the, and so that thing, so all of that happens and it's really great to build the tension and drama of this guy, you know, this assassin that he's also determined to survive just as powerfully as Popeye is determined to catch him.
Yeah. Okay. One of the things that makes the chase so strong is that they mount the camera on the front bumper of the car very low.
Okay.
And one of the things about it is when the lower you are, the closer to the ground you are, the more the illusion of speed.
Yes.
And this is where I go, I don't necessarily believe you're going 90 miles an hour
because
you don't have to. Like if you think about Raiders of the Lost Ark and him being dragged along the ground and that camera's down, they're probably going 15, 18, 20 miles an hour. Not that fast.
Right.
But it seems like you're going really fast because you're so close to the, so much detail of the ground is going by so quickly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the key things. And if you look later on at Road Warrior and other chase films, you know,
great stuff.
They put that camera real close to the ground and that gives you that sense of speed and kinetic energy. And that's part of what's making that chase scene. So in addition to the fantastic performance from Gene Hackman, in that of driving that car, his anger and his intensity and his fear and his, you could feel the adrenaline as he's driving that car.
Right.
You know, you can't separate. It's not just a series of stunts. It's it's performance and story as well as combined with that series of stunts.
The guy passes out. So the brakes, they can't hit the brakes on the train, can't drive the train. Train slams into another train. The guy gets off, stumbles out. And there's Popeye who has been, you know, barreling up, down the street. It shows up there at the bottom of the stairs. And both of them are in the same condition because they're both exhausted. Because Popeye had just had that car accident. He stumbles out of that car accident and he's there in the end. And the guy sees him, tries to run. And Popeye shoots him in the back.
How do you feel about that?
I don't mind it because of what happened beforehand.
Right.
But I love it for the shot that they use because that shot is now an iconic shot. It's been a film poster.
It's the poster.
Right, whatever. It's such a great shot. And him stumbling down is a great stunt as well because those are steel stairs you're stumbling
down. That's a real guy. He really did that. Yeah.
Well, God love him because that looked scary dangerous. You know? And so, so there we have this. This is the first chink in the armor for Alain Chanière's crew. Right? He kills his number one hitman or number one guy. And so now they're getting closer.
Yeah.
You know, to the situation.
I just want to go back to shooting in the back. Because it's a bold choice. And again, we go to this sort of the production code and what was allowed to happen. And this is a very morally ambiguous choice. Sonny Russo and Eddie Egan hated it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They're
but then what Sonny Russo says later is it was great for the film.
Yeah.
And now I like it.
Yeah.
You know, but it is like, oh, he shot him in the back.
Yeah.
And your ability to reckon with the character of Popeye Doyle continues to be problematic.
Yes.
Like, how do I feel about this guy? I don't know.
Well, and also because this guy shot a woman in the back himself, right? When he was trying to snipe Gene Hackman's character, Popeye Doyle, he sniped a woman in the back. So to me, it's a bring it full circle and point of justice in that way. Yeah.
So we managed to actually get the car.
Yeah.
And we're going to take it apart. And the mechanic in the scene is the mechanic that actually took apart the car. He's the real guy. Irving is his name.
Funny.
And he is the guy who originally took apart that car. That's just the guy.
Irving.
Yeah. And again, you see that obsessive Popeye Doyle knows he's right.
Right.
And will not quit.
But he is not proven right until Russo compares the weight.
That's right.
Which is
point.
I think is a great moment because you can be as pig-headed as you want. But if you don't have the knowledge or the facts or the information that you need to back up this pigheadedness, then you're just being a jerk or a dick. And what Russo allows him in this moment is he validates Popeye Doyle's aggressive desire to get to the truth. He validates Popeye's like instinct that he knows there's something right. in this yep. car somewhere. Yep. There's something.
Because he believes in him.
Right.
He believes right. in his partner and right. loves him.
And loves him.
Yeah.
And so comparing the weight manifest, he's like, oh, wait. This, and then they find it in the running panels?
The rocker panels.
The rocker panels, yeah, yeah. Which is great because it's a perfect place to put it. And I love the sound of, I love that. Yep. And then the taking out the foam. And then you find these green, light green and light blue packets of heroin.
Right, which is what I always keep my heroin in.
Yes, of course.
And then it's so funny when the car's been towed and our actor guy is going, I need to get my car. And it's like, no, you can't have it. You can't have it. Oh, here's your car.
You're right.
You probably should go like, hey, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. They drive off. And I have to say, our FBI guy and cop guy's plans at the final drug deal, it seemed to me like you could have come up with a better plan.
Yeah, probably.
Because the drug deal happens and then he's driving away and comes over this bridge and comes down and there's them blocking off the thing.
Yeah.
But they really haven't controlled maybe they didn't have the resources or something.
Right.
Because now they turn around and now we have a big, huge gun battle.
Why wouldn't they be waiting already?
Exactly. You're following the car.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess, you know, today we have helicopters and all this other stuff.
Well, they had helicopters back then.
They had helicopters, but I don't know how many police copters they had.
True.
And they didn't have, obviously, the radios and bugs and GPS and all the stuff we'd have today.
Right.
But still, it's like, this doesn't seem like a great plan.
Yeah.
Because we end up in a big gunfight.
Well, I mean, we get the wave from Gene Hackman, which is a great little callback. Gets the wave. Then they storm back. Oh, they drive back off. They catch all these guys. They shoot Tony LoBianco's character. Roy Scheider kills him.
Yeah.
We run into this warehouse and really all these
creepy,
guys come out.
Disturbing sort of location.
Yeah.
Bad lighting, hard to see, kind of like falling apart place.
Right.
Which probably has now been regentrified in New York and it's like a live work art space worth millions of dollars.
Yeah, loft space.
And then we have Gene Hackman again, obsessively. I know this guy's in here. I'm going to find him. And who does he kill? The FBI guy. And how much regret does Popeye Doyle have at this moment?
Zero.
Zero.
Because he reloads his gun.
And he goes, I know he's here. He doesn't go, oh, fuck, I killed an innocent guy.
Right.
Like, and this to me is the most morally difficult moment. It's not the shooting in the back. It's this moment of like, oh.
I agree.
This guy's like a sociopath.
Right.
You know? Really difficult. And then he goes into a room and we hear a gunshot.
Yeah. And that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And that's why this movie always stayed with me, because my heart broke for him as a kid that he killed the FBI guy, because it's not the guy he was trying to go after. And then he goes into the situation and we go, you hear the gunshot, black frame. And then you see, this guy was arrested, this guy, 4 years, blah, blah, blah. And the guy was never, disappeared and was never seen again. But in truth, he was caught again. He was caught and did.
No.
This guy was never caught?
No, he went back to France.
Oh.
And there was supposed to be like an extradition treaty, but they never sent him back because he's the hero and buddies with Charles de Gaulle.
Right.
He just went into hiding.
Okay.
Yeah. No, he never got. My understanding is he never got caught.
Okay.
It's a kind of. Because the movie's not spoon-feeding, you're sort of in this observation mode throughout, and you're kind of struggling with how to feel about things, that it at the end you kind of are left with, huh?
Yeah.
What do I do with this?
Yeah, but I love that because that's the film. That's the kind of films you get away with in the 70s, and you really can't now. It's really rare.
Very rare. Films that
indie get
films
away
will
with.
Do it a little bit,
right?
But,
indie films,
but,
right?
But studio.
But
films
even
aren't
those
like that.
Don't do it as often as they used to before. And so I love the ambiguous nature of certain films that end that way, because it leaves you with a lot of questions. And what we can do now, talking about it on the show, like we can discuss it, what we thought, what was the point of that, and what they got out of that. You don't know who shot who, you don't know who was killed, blah, blah, blah. And obviously later on, you know, they got reassigned and this guy was never found. So no one was really shot or killed. It just, the idea of the gunshot into the black frame leaves you with this feeling of like, well, what happened? We don't know what happened.
Well, and I think one of the things the movie makes you think about is, there's no question that the bad guys are bad guys.
Right.
That's clear.
Yeah.
But the question is, what is necessary to fight the bad guys?
Yeah, yeah.
Can we be just good guys and still get the bad guys?
Right.
And if we have to move outside the law,
yeah,
what level is okay?
Yeah.
And who is carrying the mantle or making those decisions of what level is okay?
Right.
And can we trust them?
Yeah.
Can we trust Popeye Doyle? There's no question that he cares about being a cop, and right. he's obsessively wants to get the bad guys.
Right.
But there's a lot of question about what is the damage of his methods
yeah.
throughout this film.
Yeah.
You know, when he's rousting out that bar, or when he's using some of the language he's using, or picking up the women he's picking up, and it's like, yeah. I don't trust him.
Yeah.
Because, and what we say at the beginning, he's like, you know, is that he has these hunches.
Yeah.
And sometimes those hunches are wrong. And what's the damage of that?
Right.
And I don't know the answer.
Well, that's what I thought was great about the film, is they have that FBI or the police chief guy that comes in and is like, you cost me a man. You killed a policeman with one of your hunches or instincts. You're not always right, are you? And then he's like, when they're riding in the car, he is just riding Popeye Doyle to pieces, almost to the point where they almost get into a physical altercation at the car accident scene as well.
Yeah.
You know, so there's so much tension there, and it's great to have another person in the film who's just as powerful as Popeye, taking Popeye down a peg every time he confronts him. And it lets you know, like, this guy is not someone you should revere, you know?
Right.
And that's the thing that Popeye Doyle said about when he did Joe. The reason he didn't want to do the French Connection is because he didn't like this guy.
Right.
And when he did Joe, he thought people were going to cheer against this guy, and they were cheering for him to carry out the stuff that he was doing in that film, which was very morally ambiguous and uncomfortable to watch, especially now in 2017.
But in Joe.
And
I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's an interesting film, because it's basically like falling down with Michael Douglas. Like,
oh, yeah.
He rebels against society and starts to kill like black people and kill these other people. Like, he gets too far in the vigilante aspect, and it becomes racist, and it becomes misogynist, it becomes this kind of thing. And he thought he was playing a bad character, and people were cheering in the audience. And he said when he saw that, he didn't want to play another character that was morally ambiguous that people would like. And so that's why he turned it down.
Yeah.
And so, and yes, he did want to do the romantic leads, but that was also a part of it too.
Yeah.
And so you have someone with Popeye Doyle, who is a very difficult guy to, especially in 2017, going back and rewatching the film, it's very difficult to cheer for this guy. And it's only for the force of Gene Hackman's personality and talent as an actor and charisma as an actor that you are on board with this guy and follow the sequence all the way to the end, because he does sacrifice a lot of people, including innocent civilians' lives, just to catch this guy and make a drug bust.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's funny. I said before that I don't know where I come down on this.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Yeah?
I do know where I come down on this.
Okay, where do you come
down? Yeah, but is that I believe that there's a huge responsibility in the people that carry the mantle of the rule of law.
Yeah.
And that it's more important to maintain the rule of law, that we are a nation of laws, not men. You know, it's what we talked about Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
We talked about this in LA Confidential.
Yeah.
Is in the end that individual humans shouldn't be trusted because of their bias, because of their emotional state, is that we need to fall back on the law, and it's better to let a few criminals go, in my opinion, than to violate the sanctity of our legal system. That is what I think.
Either way, it's your feeling to do the exchange, because do you arrest innocent people or do you let a few criminals go? Whatever side of the fence you're on, there is a cost.
No question
about
it.
Whatever you're comfortable
with.
Our
country very clearly...
Yeah.
sides on the better to let a few criminals go, because that is why we have the doctrine of innocent until proven guilty.
Exactly.
That is that lack of self-incrimination, you know, laws about illegal search and seizure.
Right.
They're all there knowing that that's going to make it harder to get some criminals, but it's better to protect the rights of the individual.
Exactly.
And hey, these are things we're facing today in terms of immigration and refugees and homeland security and privacy and, you know, the government wiretapping and all those things are and they're really, really hard issues. I don't want to make this seem these are easy. This is really hard.
Yeah.
Just to finish up, the movie goes on to win, I think, 4 Oscars: Best Picture, Director, Best Actor, maybe Best Editor. I think.
Yes.
And I think this is a huge influence on film moving forward.
Yeah.
It's just huge.
Yep.
I think it like kicks the door open in a way of saying we don't have to make films the way you thought we had to make films.
Right.
We don't have to have characters the way you thought we had to have characters. This can be different.
Yeah. And it launches Friedkin. He's one of these directors who has a mini run of great films and then is never able to repeat that success again. Ends up marrying Sherry Lansing from Paramount Pictures and just establishes himself as this kind of like guru of directors, right? He ends up teaching at universities, what have you. Gene Hackman explodes off of this film, done numerous things after, and still someone that people want to bring back because he's retired from acting. Everybody wants him to come back, and he just will not come back. He's so very weird. Adamant about that.
The only one I know of that really
Sean
retired.
Did the same thing. Sean Connery did, right after League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. That's it, I'm done. And some guys just don't want to be on a set anymore, man.
Well, it's not really a fun place.
No,
sets can be a really rough place.
Yes, they can.
So, John, what are your final thoughts?
This is a fantastic film to revisit, and it does ask questions of your morality, your approach and point of view about the police, about anti-heroes. It's a gritty, realistic film that really explores the underbelly of this supposedly hero cop, quote unquote. And I think it's a great plot that asks a lot of you as a viewer, like to pay attention, to focus. It does not, as Steve said earlier, it does not spoon feed you because it respects your intelligence as a viewer and as a consumer of film. And so you're like, okay, I've got to understand this, put these things together. And there's no moment of respite except for the girl with the boots and the bike. Other than that, there is no respite in this film. It is the entire film is that action sequence. From the beginning, it is barreling towards the end of that car accident to jump out and shoot the dude in the back. The entire film is like that, you know? So, and I enjoy the hell out of it. And Gene Hackman, Roy Scheider, who does not get enough credit, does not get enough love. And if you want to see another film like this, watch The 7-Ups that Roy Scheider is the lead in.
I've never seen that either.
Which is great. Yeah. I love The 7-Ups to pieces. And Tony LoBianco is in that as well. Oh. And so these 70s films that explore this stuff is so fun to go back and enjoy again. And Roy Scheider doesn't get enough credit for the stuff that he did. He is just as powerful and just as effective as Gene Hackman. And I think Fernando Rey is the perfect villain in this film.
He's great.
So, yeah.
For me, it's funny because I had to split myself into two for this. So as a lover of film and a film history and film technique and the craft and the art of filmmaking, I find this an endlessly fascinating film. Mm-hmm. As appreciation of how it was made, how different it is from movies that have come before, how important it is in the history of film in terms of a turning point, of the construction of the chase sequence and what that did to action movies throughout history.
Right.
Really, really important, and I can dig into it as sort of a scholar of film. Mm-hmm. But as a movie I love to watch, it's not a movie I love to watch.
Okay.
And I don't have a, you know, this is the thing, is that you're all going to have your favorite films,
right?
You know, and this isn't one of mine.
Okay.
And I probably won't watch it again for another 10 or 15 years.
Okay.
You know, and then I'll revisit it again. My guess is I'll have the same reaction. And so that's what we think about The French Connection. We would love to hear what you think, particularly if you haven't seen this one before. It's a really interesting film. Mm-hmm. You could always reach us on our Facebook page. That's at The Cinephiles, CINE-FILES. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, and we think you should, because there are a lot of great movies in here that you haven't seen or maybe you want to revisit, and there's a bunch of great movies coming along. And if you don't subscribe, you might miss your favorite film coming on The Cinephiles. And while you're there, I think you got an extra moment. I think you can go hit that review button. You can hit 5 stars. You can write something nice about John. You can write something terrible about me.
No,
I don't care. As long as you hit 5 stars and say something nice about John, I'll be happy.
Stop it. Please say something nice about Steve as well.
All right. You say something. All right, fine. I acquiesce. You could say something nice about both of us. If you're on Stitcher, just remember no dash, Cinephiles, no dash. You could always reach me on Twitter at SR Morris. John, where can you reach you?
Oh, guys, you can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter and on Instagram. And also go to our YouTube page.
Oh, that's right. Of course,
right,
our YouTube
page. We have
a
YouTube page now where you can go. And if you don't download podcasts, don't like to listen to podcasts, you'd rather put this on while you're cleaning the apartment or your house, or you're just hanging around in your place or hanging out in a library and you just want to listen to it and put it on your earphones, there you go. You can put it on. You can watch it on YouTube. All our episodes now, I think, are on the YouTube.
They're all up,
So you can go and just download and go back and explore them, and please leave us comments there, because we will start looking at that more and more and commenting back and what have you. So we love that. Thanks so much for all the time you give to us, all the comments you leave. We are such massive fans of you as much as you are massive fans of us, and we'll be releasing even more information coming down the pike about what we're doing with the show.
Yeah, all sorts of exciting things happening. Thanks again. That's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.